The book is That Reminds Me of a Story by Gail D. Irwin, copyrighted 1997 by Yahshua Publishing, whose phone number is 760-321-0077. Now, my name is Gail Irwin. I've chosen to read these stories to you because, after all, they are my stories. Well, let me explain. Jesus spoke to the multitudes in parables, and without a parable he did not speak to them. That's from Matthew chapter 13, verse 34. Every person that I ever met was a book waiting to be written. Usually I had opportunity only to read a phrase, occasionally a sentence, rarely a paragraph, miraculously a chapter. This is a book of phrases from my life and people I have met. For me, the joy of heaven will be to know as I am known. In heaven, I finally get to read the whole book of the life of everyone there. In the meantime, I get glimpses of heaven with only an occasional shudder of hell. Well, the stories you're about to hear are true. Occasionally, names and locations are changed or omitted for obvious reasons. Every story has a point, or a moral, or a lesson, sometimes blatant, sometimes subtle. Because there is a point, and because some might want to use these in group or family meetings, each story has applicational questions at the end for discussion or for private consideration. These stories, written because those who heard me tell them demanded it, result from the incredible life that God has given me. In the compressed and intensified experiences of my allotted years, I've learned a lot, I've laughed a lot, I've cried a lot. As you read these, I hope you will also learn, laugh, and cry, and at the same time, remember the stories in your own life, the stuff of which parables are made. And this is only the beginning. Story, The Runner. My father was a pastor. At one point in his ministry, he began taking flying lessons at a nearby community airport in order to go into the interior of the state to begin some additional churches. Once, while at the airport for a lesson, a military training plane from a nearby air base landed there. That landing violated military regulations. The pilot got out and chatted with my dad and the others there. He asked my dad, "Have you ever flown in a training plane?" "No." "Would you like to?" "Sure." "Hop in." He wasn't supposed to ask my dad, and my dad wasn't supposed to get in, but he did, and he did. This errant pilot did not use adequate runway to take off. He managed to get airborne, but was unable to clear some trees beyond the runway. He clipped the top of them, and the plane crashed. Life was changed for everybody at that moment. The pilot was not severely injured, but my father was. His brain badly damaged, and his left side paralyzed. The Air Force, dictated by military discipline, moved to throw the pilot in prison for 25 years. Now my father, who was cut from different cloth, went to bat for the pilot and pleaded with the Air Force not to be so hard on the pilot, since he had boarded the plane voluntarily. So the Air Force issued the pilot a dishonorable discharge, which is severe enough in itself. Well, we were penniless, so my parents approached the Air Force to see if they could help us. Their response? "We're not responsible because this man was not doing Air Force duty when this accident occurred. We may prosecute you for getting in the plane if you don't leave us alone." Well, now this became a civil liability case. The pilot was responsible, and he knew that. So he disappeared. My parents began a year-long hunt with government help to find him. This was before the days of computers. They know where you are now. After locating him, they wrote a letter that went like this: "Sir, apparently you are running from us, and we really don't want you to live this way. Please know that we forgive you, and absolve you of all liability. You owe us nothing. And my wife and I are both signing this letter so you can live free. We only ask that you let us know you received the letter and that you accept what we say." There was no answer. A couple of months later, they sent a copy of the letter. This one came back, stamped on the front, moved, left no forwarding address. He was running. My parents renewed the hunt. Another year passed before they found him. He had moved a great distance away. Once again they wrote him. This time, the letter expressed more urgency. "Sir, obviously you are running from us, and we really, really don't want you to live this way. Please, please know that we forgive you, and you owe us nothing. We want you to live free, so my wife and I are signing this letter again. We only ask that you let us know that you receive the letter and that you accept what we say." There was no answer. A couple of months later, they sent another copy of the letter. This one came back, stamped on the front, moved, left no forwarding address. He was running. Unlike our God, who is much more persistent, this attempt ended my parents' search. So, somewhere on this planet, a man still runs, terrified that I might find him. Yet he holds in his hands a letter, all that he needs to live free. He just doesn't believe it and won't receive it. Well, as I pondered this event, I realized that millions more on this planet are running from God, terrified that he might find them. Yet they hold in their hands a letter, a Bible, all they need to live free. They just don't believe it and won't receive it. At the end of each of my chapters, there are discussion questions, and here are the ones for this chapter. Question 1. How has God pursued you in the past? Question 2. Do you know someone who is running? What actions do you observe? Question 3. Have you ever tried to let someone know that you forgive them? What was the response? The story? Hands. The right hand. Well over 1 billion people on this planet eat with their hands, not because they don't know better. It's their tradition, a revered and very efficient way of life. One common thread exists for those who eat with their hands. They all eat with their right hand. This is more than symbolic, since the left hand is reserved for personal cleanliness functions. In countries where this right-hand tradition is strongest, if you touch a dish on the table with your left hand, the dish will be silently and immediately removed. Don't expect your host to correct you. He never will. He may wonder at your rudeness or crudeness, but he will never correct you. Once, on my first trip to India in 1976, I was eating in the home of an outstanding Christian leader. Their precocious and verbal 4-year-old had been banished to another room to eat while I was there. Partway through the meal, I heard him loudly call for his father's attention. When his father responded, the boy asked, "Is he eating with his left hand?" Well, obviously he had been warned that I might do so and was told not to make an issue of it. To the embarrassed father, I smiled and said, "Well, I know some important things to remember now. This hand separation does, as would be expected, extend to symbolism. In Zimbabwe, I carefully gave and received gifts only with my right hand. To do otherwise would be an insult unless the person knew you very well and understood that you were simply an ignorant American." One significant symbolism parks unforgettably in my mind. Often when a gift is presented to someone, they'll receive the gift with their right hand and will cup their left hand under their right hand as if to give it support. This is their way of saying that your gift is too heavy or too much for them to receive only with one hand, so they must support their hand. This is their way of honoring your worthiness or the value of your gift, as they also say, thank you. In similar fashion, when you shake hands with someone, he might grasp his right wrist with his left hand as a way of saying that shaking hands with you is too heavy for me, as if to say I'm unworthy to be shaking hands with you. People say many things non-verbally if you carefully observe. Pocket hands. Zimbabwean native men do not walk around with their hands in their pockets as I and many Americans nonchalantly do. They keep their hands out of their pockets because they believe that to put them in your pockets means you have money or some reason to put your hands there. This makes pocket hands a signal of wealth or position. Being mostly poor people, they consider it arrogant to place their hands in their pockets. Perhaps it's okay for us Americans to walk around with our hands in our pockets, since by world standards we are all wealthy, but not them. I shall never forget a dramatic moment in the history of the Zimbabwean church. A Bible school had been built and in full swing for several years, but they had no chapel, no gathering place for the students, or meeting hall for conferences. With their own hands, they dug the foundations, made the bricks, and built a large building. I was there on that joyous day when they dedicated the new building, the largest on campus. The building was filled with pastors and leaders from all over the country. The speaker, a leading businessman who led the dedication, at the close of his message told the hands-in-the-pocket tradition, then said, "Now we have something. We are rich. I want everyone to walk around here at the front with their hands in their pockets." Well, I plunged my hands in my pockets and joined them, proudly strutting around that building and smiling hard enough to hurt my face. Grandma's hands. When my grandparents retired and moved from the farm to the city, I did not know of a promise my grandmother had made. For so long they lived on a farm somewhat remote from church, even more remote when the bridge washed out, which happened often. My grandmother so hungered to go to church that she promised the Lord, if he let them move to the city, she would go to church every day that she could. That promise deeply affected my life in this way. My parents moved away from the city while I was in the ninth grade. Wanting to finish that grade in my school, I persuaded everybody to let me live with my grandparents and finish the ninth grade, ignorant of the fact that I would be going to church almost every night. Whenever revival meetings appeared in the newspaper, we geared up Grandpa and Grandma's old Pontiac and began the search drive for wherever the meeting would be located. We saw some strange things and some wonderful things. Since my grandmother drove as one trained on a trafficless farm, my grandfather's blindness worked to his benefit. She felt that proper driving meant positioning the hood ornament over the line in the middle of the road. Grandpa was mercifully blind. The strangeness of some meetings fueled good discussions when we returned home. Grandpa helped me learn how to pick out the biblical from the non-biblical in our observation. I value that more now than I did then. However, living in their home left me with some warm memories as well as hot knowledge. My grandmother lived in the kitchen. She loved me, and I knew it. Whenever I passed nearby in the kitchen, she would reach up and pat me on the cheek. Flour from her hands flew everywhere. If I licked my lips, she baked me a chocolate cake. They don't make cakes like that anymore. Or hands. Going to church every night had an upside apart from the spiritual. When we arrived home, she always made me a sandwich and a cup of tea. So, anytime I visit you and refuse coffee, asking instead for a cup of tea, think of my grandma's hands. Discussion.
What customs in your life involve the use of your hands? What meanings do they have? Number two, if someone were to write a story in the future about your hands, what might they say? Number three, if you could wash your hands of some particular problem, what would it be?
The story, Jake. Jake broke the meter on meanness. He was a logger whose favorite sport when he had a little bit of alcohol in his system was to go to a little local church and beat up the deacons. Leadership required commitment there. Jake's meanness was exceeded only by his ugliness. The one tooth remaining in the front of his mouth deterred any smiles and inhibited anyone seeking a smile. I met Jake only because of one remarkable event. My father, severely injured in an accident when I was 6 years old, attempted to return to ministry by teaching for a week at a tiny church in a logging community. Scurrying to find beds for each member of the family, the church assigned me that week to the home of a faithful church-going lady who had a son my age. Their house sat near the top of a wooded hill. Water was retrieved by walking about 200 yards down a steep side of a hill to a spring and carrying heavy buckets of water up to the house. The husband of the house was Jake. I was in enemy territory. The whole family lived in constant terror, worrying that they might set Jake off in a furious and violent tirade. We all walked on eggshells. I almost enjoyed going down the hill for water. At least being away from the house offered some relaxation. One day, the chore assigned to my friend and me meant carrying bucket after bucket of water up that hill. I watched as the large black pot of water was heated up by a wood fire outside, so clothes could be scrubbed on an old scrub board and hung out to dry. Washing was hard work, but that was life, and no other alternatives presented themselves. As if it were yesterday, I can remember the Wednesday night when Jake showed up at church. Nervousness skittered across the crowd. Was Jake drunk? Was he going to beat someone up? Why was Jake even here? He never comes to church except to beat someone up. But this was Jake's night. At the invitation, Jake stood and made his way down front to kneel. Everyone was awestruck. They wondered if this was a new trick of Jake's. Well, the next night, Jake returned. Shock like a small earthquake registered on each person. At the midpoint of the service, my father asked if anyone wanted to report on what God was doing in their lives. Jake stood up and said, "I have something to say." I could tell that he would be permitted to say anything he wanted. "Last night when I came here, I hated you people." Heads nodded in recognition of that fact. "But something happened to me, and I don't understand this, but tonight, I love you." He smiled, and the one ugly tooth had somehow become beautiful. Even at the tender age of 6, I knew that Jake had the goods. I saw the fruit in the home where I was staying. Joy reigned. Salvation does that. Other similar events in my life I decided to call Jake moments. On a Sunday morning, I had finished a message in a small suburb community church in a rural area of Southern California. The invitation was being issued by the pastor. I sat and watched. Suddenly, a man midway back in the congregation slowly stood up. He stood there for only a second when his wife, sitting next to him, shot up, wrapped her arms around him, and began to sob. I knew at that moment that a home had been restored. Joy would now reign. I wept and remembered Jake. In the Dakotas, I watched as a high school teenager newly in the kingdom, was hugged by his father, also new in the kingdom, for the first time in his life. They were both sobbing like babies. Another Jake moment. Another moment happened in Philadelphia, just as it had happened years earlier in that small South Dakota town. At the close of a men's retreat, I was watching as God was doing his thing in the hearts of the men during a communion service, when I spotted a man coming toward me whose feet seemed not to be touching the ground as he bounded along, his face locked in a maximum smile. His story made it clear. Tonight, my father became a Christian, and for the first time I heard him say, "I love you," to me. I just put down a letter from a young lady in Washington State, thanking me for the fact that her grandfather had accepted the Lord in a service I conducted. Her grandfather, whom she loved dearly, had resisted following the Lord until that moment, and he said that I made it so clear. Now he had passed away, and the family was ecstatic that he knew the Lord. Jake, you just don't know what you started. The sermon had concluded at Fort Lauderdale. The worship team was playing, and Bob Coy, the pastor, had invited those who wanted to become Christians to come forward. I stood slightly to his side and watched. I noticed an old man making his way down toward the front. Now, that's unusual enough to catch my attention. He wasted no time, and rather than stand waiting for instructions to go to a prayer room, fell to his knees at the steps of the platform. Moved by that, I wondered what was going on in his heart. I should have watched for two hearts. A form moved by me on the platform, almost unnoticed, until he knelt beside the old man. It was George, one of the worship musicians, and that was his dad who had come forward. He had prayed for his dad for a long time, and now the fruit knelt, father and son, beside each other. A Jake moment. Shortly before my 21st birthday, I conducted a week of meetings in my old home church in Chester, Oklahoma, where they were kind enough to give this old homeboy a chance. In that community lived a farmer known for his hostility to Christianity. His wife was a strong and faithful Christian who loved to be involved in the church, but her husband despised every moment. If he spotted her car on the road, he would jump in his pickup and leave his field to chase her. He would stop and search her car to make sure she wasn't taking food or some other form of gift to the church. But the meaner he got, the nicer she treated him. Well, I knew him, and was most shocked to see him come to one of the evening services. At the close, in response to the invitation, he quickly made his way forward and knelt. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Well, afterward, I made a mistake and asked him what I said that had moved him to come forward. He assured me that his move had nothing to do with what I said. He only wanted me to hurry up and quit so he could get saved. He told me that he could not continue his way of living. He made life a hell for his wife, and the worse he treated her, the better she treated him. He decided that he had to have what she had. When I last saw him, before he went to be with the Lord, he was a deacon. Another Jake. Maybe you have a Jake moment in your life. Maybe you need one. Discussion question one. Who experienced the most dramatic conversion you have ever seen? What was the change? Question two. For whom are you praying now for a conversion, and what change do you expect to see? Question three. From whom would you like to hear, "I love you"? And to whom would you like to say, "I love you"? The story, Airport Drama. When surrounded by crowds, you rarely notice individuals. However, some personal scenes grab your attention and will not let you go. Often as I wait for a plane, I observe personal anguish or tragedies, perhaps people arriving for a funeral or accompanying someone virtually disabled. You try not to stare, but you do notice, and you share in their pain. I noticed something different happening in Denver. I was waiting for my plane connection to arrive and concentrating on my reading. Now, there are always others waiting to greet arrivals, but this group caught my eye. An older couple, accompanied by a nervously pacing young man, looked out the window by the gate to see if the plane had arrived. The older couple seemed to feel out of place in the airport. Through his thick glasses, I could see quizzical and concerned eyes. In the noise, only smatterings of conversation came through. "Are you sure she's coming?" "Yes, she said this flight." "Does she know we want to see her?" "No." "Does she want to see us?" "She doesn't know you're here. This is a surprise." As the intercom announced that the plane had landed, the younger man quickly ushered the couple across the hall where they could not be readily seen. Then he came back to wait beside the door for passengers. Anxious glances passed back and forth across the hall. By now they had my complete attention, though I tried not to be too obvious. My detective mind started to piece the scene together. Was this a runaway coming home? Was this a long-lost relative being reunited? Was a torn relationship about to be repaired? Was this young chap the engineer? With the young man, I watched each person burst from the walkway leading from the plane. I tried to guess which one it would be. No one brightened his face. No recognition came. Finally, the exodus stopped. The man's glances and agitation were matched by the couple across the hallway. The young man started down the gangway to see if anyone else was coming. No one was. The older couple, walking in a pool of disappointment, made their way across the aisle to join the young man. All smiles were gone. His best efforts had not produced the healing connection. One more glance down the walkway from the plane proved futile. They turned to go. He shrugged and said, "I don't understand. This is the plane she was supposed to be on." "I don't understand." I found my feelings matching theirs. As they began to walk away, heightened hope would not let the young man go without one more look down the walkway. Aha! Indeed, someone was coming. I could see a baby stroller just coming away from the plane. Quiet conversation became shouted orders. The older couple rushed back to their place across the terminal aisle. The man greeted the young lady as she came through the door, then knelt down to see the baby. The conversation began. "I was worried. The plane emptied and I did not see you." She ignored his statement to place her own question. "Do you think they want to see me? Are they angry?" Just as he was smiling to answer, the older couple approached. Tears followed the embraces and smiles. As the older couple knelt to touch the baby, the girl said to the child, "Meet your grandpa and grandma." Reunion complete. Happiness restored. Prodigal returned. Now I understood. As they walked away, I raised my paper higher and closer to my face. I'm still not comfortable letting people watch me cry. Discussion question number one. What kind of scene makes you cry? Question two. Did you ever come home or know someone who did? What was the reception like? Question three. How did individuals in this story act like God? The story, Kenneth. In research for a possible history book, I discovered that Kenneth was just days away from election as state leader in his denomination. Then he was struck down. I also discovered that state leaders in that denomination had a horrible record in preserving their children from the disillusionment of the politics of that office. What might have happened to me, his son, had he received that office? I don't know. Some understandings await their fulfillment in heaven. Others also wondered at this accident that left his left side paralyzed and downgraded him from leader to survival. Perhaps you remember the runner. However, his spirit was never broken. You'll want to see Half a Brain and Jake. This reduction from being the breadwinner of the household never sat well with him. Every few months birthed a new attempt to live gainfully. He raised hogs, raised rabbits, trapped wild rabbits, hauled wheat. I say he, but I really mean we. Everywhere he went, I had to go as his caretaker and do most of the work. I was killing and skinning rabbits at age 8, gathering slop, that's a lost word in our urban society, for hogs, by age 9. This whole intrusion into my childhood was a slingshot to maturity. His loss of earning power also meant poverty for the family, and living in conditions that news programs a decade later were spotlighting. Though this grinds on the core of any man, it failed to break his spirit. Also, never once did he seek or receive any form of government assistance to alleviate our need. If you were to describe my dad by one word, it would be believer. He trusted God. Whatever else you might say to describe him, you had to say he trusted God. His Bible, which I now own, is frayed from constant use. Every trip home from college included a time for us to discuss the Bible together. Often we would have to go over passages again and again because he kept forgetting what we had discussed. Now I can see how God was making sure that I learned. Actually, our real learning came from the Bible. Before I began my brief career as a newsboy, Dad took me to Proverbs and had me read chapter 22, verse 1. A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold. Whatever my business in life might be, uprightness far exceeded wealth in desirability. The night before I left for college, he stood at my bedroom door while I slept, as he related to me later, and prayed for me. Then he said, "Well, Gail, I've taken you as far as I can. From now on, it's just you and God." I cannot even read this without crying. We depended upon the miraculous. Survival was impossible without God's intervention, but intervene God did. By the time I headed for college, the reality of God and His Word were so wrapped at the core of me that all attempts by the school's liberal religious approach to weaken or deprive my faith were far too late and much too weak. I, too, had become a believer. His injuries took their final toll after 32 years, but the memory of his greatness and his wealth of friends filled the church which he had founded and built, and where his funeral service was conducted. At his funeral, my two brothers and I stood in front of his casket and made the following statement to all those who had gathered. Our father did not leave a financial empire for us to carry on. Many things that a dad normally does with his sons, ours was unable to do. He was unable to teach us many things that a dad normally teaches, but he did leave us something that he had. He left us with a love of God, a love for the Bible, a love of people, an understanding of worship, and an inability to hate. We feel that He has left us only those things that will last, so we stand before You as His sons and declare publicly that we will follow His God. Discussion Question 1. Describe the joys and difficulties of relating to your father. Question 2. How has being a follower of Jesus affected your relationship with your father? Question 3. If you are a father, what do you wish most for your children or your family? The story, JCCVP. I was downtown to deliver the high school paper to the local newspaper, who would carry it as a whole page in their Friday edition. From an office across the street, a businessman beckoned for me to come over. He was the vice president of the National Junior Chamber of Commerce, and I was honored that he would notice me, a mere high school student. I sat down in his office, wondering why he had flagged me. He said that he had been watching my activities in high school and wanted to compliment me. He also wanted to contribute something to my life, so he began a short lecture on what he considered to be the three most important decisions a person would ever make. The most important, he said, is the decision about whom you will serve. I want to urge you to truly serve God. That decision I knew I had already made. Second, you must decide what you will do with your life, how you will make a living, what contribution you will make to society. I thought I had that settled and a desire to be a medical doctor. Finally, you must decide who your partner will be in life. Failure to make wise decisions in any of these three can destroy you. This decision was yet to be made in my life. I thanked him and left, pondering this moment, the only time, as it turned out, that I would ever meet him. But nonetheless, a moment filled with wisdom. Discussion questions. Number 1. When you need advice, where do you go? Question 2. What is the best advice you have ever received? Question 3. Which of the three decisions in our story have you made? Describe how and when you did. The story, Charlie Brown. He refused to tell me later what he thought of me the first time we met. I remember that meeting well. My relationship with his daughter had grown to the point that it was time for me to meet her parents. Trailways bus was the only way to get to Ripley. Well, one could drive if one possessed a car, but I was a poverty-struck college freshman who had hitchhiked from Jackson, Mississippi to Memphis, Tennessee, as my monthly custom had become. The bus inched for 20 years, or so it seemed, to my sweaty palms as we headed north. 3 earthquakes rumbled through my heart. Earthquake number 1 was akin to stag fever, that awe that disables the trigger finger when prey is spotted. So with me. I was trying to be super cool so that Tennessee's best doe, which I had cornered in the bus, wouldn't be skittish and run. Earthquake 2 shook my most vulnerable pillars. I was a bull being run into the auctioneer's arena to see if anyone would buy. This was an approval run. Would they like me, or wouldn't they? Now that question shatters an 18-year-old far more than a mid-century man. Earthquake 3 was an embarrassing physical condition caused by an activity that has since been declared illegal. Upperclassmen at the college I had just entered hazed the freshmen by shaving their heads when they arrived and forcing them to wear little skullcap beanies. So I was totally bald, and bald was not in for 18-year-olds in 1956. I still don't think my head is designed for bald, though nature seems to have bettered me now in that argument. Indeed, I haven't any indication that nature has ever been listening to me. Football practice and a training table had reduced my neck and increased my shoulders. Tables, reductions, and increases still go on, but the locations are different. I look like a stump with a bowling ball sitting on top. I can laugh about it now. Fortunately, my Doe's family was too civil to laugh in my presence. I'm not sure they ever laughed. Maybe prayed. Maybe cried, took aspirin, but not laughed. It must have been stressful for him, because years later, when I asked him what he thought when he first met me, he would only say, "We love you, son." "I know that, Dad, but what did you first think of me?" "It's okay. We love you, son." That was all I could ever get out of him, and he did love me, too. Every meal he would hover over me, making sure my plate was always full long after I was, urging me like some protective mother every minute, on the minute, to keep eating when my hands were busier refusing than forking. He was thoroughly Christian. I watched him prove that with his life. The most agitated I ever saw him resulted from a misunderstanding with a neighbor. He could not rest until the problem had been resolved. He didn't bother to read the paper or listen to the news much, so his mind lacked the clutter of our day. He lived by priceless values ignored by those who strive for gold. He loved God and people, and sought to provide all things honest in the eyes of man. Well, newspapers were ignorant of his name, but the townspeople weren't. They held him in highest respect. If he said something, it was true. If he recommended, they seriously considered. As a 21-year-old looking for places to preach, he took me to meet three people, mildly suggested they ought to have me preach for them, and I had three meetings scheduled immediately. I married his daughter on Thanksgiving Day of 1957. Only hospitals and police stations even thought of being open on that day in this country town, but my car had rejected its muffler that morning, emitting a sound hardly appropriate to ferry my bride and his last child away from him. No problem. He made two phone calls and a store plus a service station open to supply and install a muffler on the car on this holiday. Everyone seemed happy to accommodate him. On one of my last visits with him, I noticed a plaque on the wall that I had not seen there before. His church presented a certificate to him to acknowledge and honor his 50 years as a deacon. A doctorate from Harvard could not have been a higher honor. Once he grabbed my heart in a way that I was never able to tell him. I had been preaching in Nashville and had some spare time, so I rented a car and drove over to visit with them. Exhausted, I took time for a nap and asked them to awaken me for dinner. When the time came, Dad entered the room, crawled onto the bed, and kissed me on the cheek. "It's time to get up, son." The severe circumstances of my own childhood had left an empty spot where tendernesses like that are supposed to lodge. At that moment, Dad Brown had loosened that crusty lid and poured a fresh emotional freedom into my jar. It was too deep for me to ever tell him. I miss him. He went to be with the Lord in 1987. He was 87. Charlie Brown of Ripley, Tennessee. Dad Brown, my father-in-law. Discussion questions. Number one, if you are an in-law, what could cause your new relatives to pick you as a friend if you were not in the family? Question two, in what ways have you grown because of in-laws? This can include overcoming difficulties. Question three, what anxieties have you faced in choosing a spouse for life?
The story, Elma. Elma was the strong one. She was a middle daughter in a family of nine brothers and an older sister, and responsibility fell to her in that early 1900s family that would have staggered a lesser person. Elma was very young when she and Charlie finally eloped after several unsuccessful attempts and let a justice of the peace tie the knot. He tied it well. When I met Elma, she and Charlie ran a mom-and-pop grocery store, an institution now almost extinct, beside the highway next to their house. Her quiet strength became quickly obvious. She was now caring for her own mother, who lived out her declining years in a cabin behind their house. Though she would laugh a lot, especially if I said something funny, she was mostly matter-of-fact. Being an entrepreneur, wife, mother, and nurse meant there was just too much to do to take time for small talk. She watched me carefully, wondering at this shaved head, beaten face, college freshman football player who had come to ask if they would turn their only cherished daughter over to him to take her away forever? It was a difficult year waiting for the strange, shaved-head outsider to take away their daughter. Ensuing hairier visits did little to ease her misgivings. There were certain givens in her life. She never missed church. She never considered sin. She never let an enemy remain one. She never complained. She never considered hospitality anything but natural. Her house was constant host to family, who often lived with her for extended periods, to large meals, and to other guests. The tragedy of losing the youngest of three sons in a drowning accident hung constantly unspoken in her heart. Her parenting heart was bigger than the four children naturally allotted to her, so she frequently kept foster children. She celebrated 60 years of faithfulness with Charlie and could have celebrated more had it not been for the illness that ended his life. As she waits out her days in a care center visited daily by her children but largely unaware of her surroundings, it seems further evidence that a just God would arrange for a resurrection. Discussion question one. What work or chores do you have simply because you're in a family? Question two. What work do you do that is not required of you simply because you have the skills and enjoy doing it? Question three. What would you say you have been doing for the long haul? The story, Ada. When I was in high school in Greenwood, Mississippi, a National Junior Chamber of Commerce leader asked me to drop by his office. He had something he wanted to say to me. In summary, he said, every person makes three great choices: whom he will serve, what he will do, and with whom he will spend his life. Be wise in those choices. You might want to go back and re-listen to JCCVP. The choice of whom I would serve had long been settled. I never wanted to be anything but a follower of Jesus. I thought I had settled the second, to be a surgeon. The third was still ahead of me. I didn't know that all three would be settled within a year and in surprising ways. In February of 1956, I was featured in a national youth magazine
because of some honors that had come to me in high school. A young lady who subscribed to the magazine and lived about 200 miles away saw the article and did a most uncharacteristic thing for her. She wrote me a letter suggesting that we exchange ideas about youth work since we were both involved in church leadership. Her neat left-slanted handwriting that carefully detailed her faith captured my interest. I was encouraged by the fact that because of her faithful Christian service, the same youth magazine that featured me gave a similar write-up of her. More letters and ideas, and then photos, were exchanged between Ripley, Tennessee and Greenwood until she moved to Memphis to continue schooling and told me to come see her if I was ever up that way. Well, I happened to be ever up that way one day, and met Ada Faye Brown one summer afternoon in 1956. She was quite popular, being courted by an extensive group of men, but I soon had her exclusive attention. Now that I had a reason to go to Memphis, I could catch a ride with whomever I could. College moved me 100 miles farther away, but about once a month, as a shaved-head freshman football player, I would thumb a ride up Highway 51 from Jackson, Mississippi to Memphis. There I stayed in the YMCA, ready to see Ada every chance her job would permit on a weekend, and then take a miserable 1 o'clock a.m. bus ride back to Jackson. A kickoff collision at a football game in Arkansas cracked my back in 4 places, and I was flown back to Jackson for a week's stay in the hospital. By the middle of the week, Ada was there to see me, and that was all I needed to make my decision. Thanksgiving Day was bitterly cold in Memphis, and the brace I wore under my shirt seemed to make me more vulnerable to the wind. But all of that was inconsequential to the yes that I had received from her that day. A year later, also on Thanksgiving Day, my father tied the knot for us in her home church in Ripley. Now, all the great decisions had been made, and I was only 19. God had tugged me toward preaching and delivered Tennessee's best to me. I've often kidded Ada that she agreed to marry a future surgeon, but ended up with a poor preacher. She assured me that she knew all along she would marry a preacher. I believe that, too. Her teen years were filled with traveling and playing the piano for church functions. Her life had been as resolved as my own. She wanted only to be a follower of Jesus. Her family was deeply involved with the church, her father a 50-year veteran of deaconship. Nonetheless, one is never quite prepared for the road marriage takes. Despite what all the manuals say, the constantly new adventure of marriage is similar to walking on water. Ada lived on the water. She has borne the pain of 4 births and 1 miscarriage and loved our children to successful adulthood. She mastered both the kitchen and the checkbook, carefully stewarding us to far more than my salary could ever provide. Her hospitality, often instant and sometimes massive, was a model others have copied. The early junkyard sow's ear of provision I gave her was woven into a silk purse of decorative skill, making our home a center of comfort. Never once could I wonder about her faithfulness, though she was often alone from my extensive travels. We have laughed, we have played, we have loved, and we have fought. On my schedule for late November every year, a large block of time is marked celebration. During that time, thanks to airlines who've seen my face frequently enough to reward me, Ada and I will be in who knows where, celebrating umpteen years of marriage, a tribute to a lady who had the character to make marriage happen. Thanksgiving seems an appropriate name for our day. Discussion question one. If you are married, tell how you and your spouse met. What were some of the memorable marks of your courtship? Question two. What role do you feel God has played in the strong relationships you have developed? Question three. What main strengths do you feel your spouse or a close friend has?